Hi everyone, Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. And in today's episode, we have my dear friend, Anahad O'Connor, who's a journalist for the New York Times. We're gonna be talking with Anahad about an important question, which is there a perfect diet for human beings? He has a lot to say on this topic based on an article that he wrote for the Times. Stay tuned, super fascinating conversation. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast. I'm your host, Drew Prode. Each week, my team and I invite a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and live more. This week's guest on the podcast is my dear friend, Anahad O'Connor. Anahad O'Connor is a best-selling author and reporter for the New York Times. He joined the paper in 2003 and writes for the Science Times, the paper's weekly science and health section, and the Well blog. Anahad covers nutrition, medicine, chronic disease, and more. He's published a number of groundbreaking investigative stories for the Times, including a series in 2015 that exposed Coca-Cola's funding of scientific research that sought to downplay the role of sugar-sweetened beverages in the obesity epidemic. In 2018, he and his colleagues won an award from the Association of Healthcare Journalists for Planet Fat, a series that examined the food industry's role in the spread of global obesity. Anahad is a frequent guest on national news programs such as PBS NewsHour, Good Morning America, and NPR's All Things Considered. And he's the author of four books. A graduate of Yale University, Anahad lives here where we're filming in San Francisco, California, with his wife, a women's rights attorney. And congratulations on being a father, and thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you. It is so awesome to be here. Thanks for having me.
I've been a big fan of your articles, and so it's just great to have you here to talk about them because you've covered a number of really interesting topics in this field. And I feel in a way you've given so much credibility to emerging science in the space of nutrition, obesity, and exercise. So to get the individual who's actually penning these articles on here is a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, it's awesome to be here. You know, it's a topic that I love covering. I feel like this is an area that where there's a lot of confusion among the public, but it's something that is universal to everyone. Everyone's interested in, you know, what they should eat, you know, how and when they should exercise and what they can do to improve their health. And those are some of the questions I try to answer with my articles.
And it seems like a perfect storm is happening right now. We have this emerging amount of research that's coming. More money than ever in the space of nutrition and lifestyle and exercise, maybe still not enough to really prove all the things that we want to look into. But then there's the consumer demand and the public interest. And then bigger papers like the New York Times are really spearheading the way by having more coverage on these topics because they're seeing that their readers and listeners want to do it. And I want to jump right in with one of your most popular articles that you went into, which is the title of this podcast, which is there an optimal diet for humans? And in this article that you wrote, you covered an interesting study that I'd love for you to share with our listeners that was featured in the Journal of Obesity Reviews. Tell us about this study and how you came to discover it.
Right. So nutrition is a very divisive topic. It's something that most people are very passionate about. I like to say that discussing nutrition is like discussing religion. You know, there are very strong feelings on different sides. And all you have to do is wade into, you know, social media to see that there are people who are very passionate about their diets, whether it's, you know, being vegan or keto or paleo, Mediterranean diet. There's sort of been these diet wars for a long time. And a group of researchers decided to take a look at, you know, is there an actual optimal diet for the human race? So what they did was they looked at hunter-gatherer societies around the world, and there are hundreds of them. These are people who live sort of the way they have for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Yeah, they're modern-day hunter-gatherer societies.
Exactly.
Not groups that are like extinct.
Yes, exactly. And these are groups like the Hadza in Tanzania, groups like the Chimani that live in South America, in Bolivia, indigenous groups in Australia. They're sort of spread across the globe, and they figured, you know, we can look at these groups to sort of see, you know, what are the diets that humans sort of naturally choose and live on, and are healthiest on. They also look through the fossil record to see, you know, what are the different foods that humans have been eating for thousands of years. And one of the reasons they did this is because when you look at modern hunter-gatherer societies, they don't have a lot of the diseases that Americans and the Western world does. So, you know, the leading killers of Americans are heart disease, you know, cancer, lung disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's, you know, all these obesity-related conditions, all these, you know, chronic non-communicable diseases. But when you look at hunter-gatherer populations, they don't have these diseases. They tend to live to old age pretty free from heart disease, from obesity, from diabetes. These conditions are very scarce. And now that's not to say that, you know, they are in the best health or that they have the easiest lives. They die from other things like
accidents,
infections, pneumonia. You know, when they're out hunting, you know, they have to worry about being attacked by an animal or, you know,
infant mortality is
off the charts in these groups. But what's interesting is that, you know, they die from things that in the Western world, you know, we know how to prevent or control. You know, we have antibiotics, we have, you know, modern medicine to prevent and treat these infections, the things that kill them. And so there's sort of a mismatch in our sort of world where we are dying from diseases today that we didn't die from 100, 200, you know, thousands of years ago. And you still see that today in modern hunter-gatherer groups. You know, they are pretty free from these chronic diseases that take, you know, a lot of lives in the United States and across the developed world.
So tell us a little bit more about the study and some of the things that they were looking at, especially when it came to the diet. What did these groups have in common? And did they finally discover the one or two foods that we should all be eating and the same diet that we should all be on?
Yeah. So they said, you know, we know that nutrition, diet plays a huge role in health. That's pretty well established. So when you look at all these groups, hundreds of them across the globe, you look at, you know, the fossil record and see what humans have been eating for thousands of years, you know, what is the optimal diet? And it turns out that there is no optimal diet.
Shocker.
Yes, shocker. That was the twist. It turns out that humans can do very well on a wide range of diets. There are hunter-gatherer groups that, you know, live on a diet that's 80% carbs. There are some that live on a diet that's, you know, pretty scarce when it comes to carbs. There are some that eat mostly meat, some that eat mostly plants, but they did find some pretty broad strokes. So they found that pretty much across the board, they eat a mix of meat, fish, and plants. They found that they get a lot of fiber in their diets, you know, many times the amount of fiber that Americans and people in the developed world get. They find that in some cases they actually do eat sugar as well, but not the kind of sugar that we normally eat. They get their sugar from honey.
Right. Honey was the only source of sugar that they had access to.
Pretty much. And they find that some of these groups actually love honey. It's one of their, you know, coveted food sources among the Chimani, for example, and some other groups. But it's pretty seasonal. You know, during the dry season, the Chimani, the Hadza, who live in Tanzania, which is, you know, one of the oldest hunter-gatherer groups on the planet. They actually are known for having, you know, the oldest human diet, which dates back thousands of years. During the dry season, they will eat a lot of meat. During other seasons, they will get up to 20% of their calories from sugar or from honey, rather. And they do very well. You know, they have, you know, they live pretty free from heart disease, obesity, diabetes. You know, so they managed to do very well on this varied diet. And you sort of see that across the globe, that humans can do very well on a wide range of diets.
When you were reading this study and you were looking at some of the findings, what came up for you personally? You know, I know you have a passion for nutrition yourself. In addition to just writing about it, you're very interested in it. You have a passion for exercise, for working out. You're just generally interested in these topics. When you read it, were you like, okay, I kind of knew this, but this confirmed it? Or was any of the information surprising to you?
I think that it sort of confirms this idea that there's no one single diet that works very well for everyone. And if you sort of, you know, look around, you can sort of see this anecdotally and even in studies. You know, there are some people who do very well on a vegan diet, some people who don't. There's some people who do extremely well on a keto diet, some people who don't. And you see that even in studies that compare low carb diets to low fat diets, you know, to Mediterranean diet. Usually when you look at the conclusions of these weight loss studies, they will say, oh, on average, the people in the low carb group lost, you know, 5 pounds. In the low fat group, they lost 4 pounds. But if you actually dig into the data, a lot of times you'll see that these are just the averages. And there are some people who may have lost 10, 15 pounds on the low carb diet, and some people who gained, you know, 3, 4, 5 pounds on that diet. Some people who lost, you know, 10 pounds on a low fat diet and then, you know, had no impact for others. And then, you know, some who gained weight on that diet. So you sort of see anecdotally and even in studies that there's no one single diet that we should all be eating. We can do well on a range of diets. But there were some other things from this study that I thought were pretty interesting. So across these groups, you know, one food that they don't eat or one food group is ultra processed foods. You know, they are eating whole foods, you know, meat that they go out and hunt for. They are eating, you know, very starchy plants. So, you know,
tubers,
things like cassava, you know, these very thick, you know, densely fibrous plants. And that's where they're getting, you know, this huge amount of fiber from in most cases. Even the, you know, in cases where they're gathering fruit and they're eating like wild berries, the berries are different from the very sweet, plump, domesticated berries that you see, you know, at the supermarkets here in America. The berries that they are eating in Tanzania, for example, with the Hadza, are pretty large and have very big seeds in them and very little flesh. So you have to eat a lot of them to get, you know, the sweet, fleshy part out of them. But they're eating these whole foods. They're not eating, you know, these ultra processed foods that you find in packages here in America. And, you know, that obviously, you know, will seem like, okay, that's a no brainer. But I think that has a big impact on our diet. You know, I was interviewing a food addiction researcher at the University of Michigan. And, you know, she pointed this out. You know, they did a big study there where they actually looked at people who had either diagnosed food addictions or who had symptoms of food addiction where, you know, they had things like severe cravings. They had, you know, a lot of mental distress around food where, you know, they wanted to stop eating certain foods, but they couldn't and they would have binges. So these sort of qualities that sort of rank there with food addiction. And they actually had, you know, this group of people, they looked at them using the Yale Food Addiction Survey to rank the foods that they had the most trouble with. And the top 10 foods that people tend to have the most problems with when it comes to food addiction, number one was pizza. Number two was chocolate. Also on that list, ice cream, potato chips, cake, fried chicken. You know, basically there's one thing that all of these foods had in common that people struggle with the most. And that thing is that these are foods that are all high in refined carbs and fat. They're combinations of fat and either sugar or refined carbs. Those are the foods that really tap into the reward system in the brain that people cannot get enough of. And they just, you know, will binge and, you know, can't control themselves with. And those are foods that don't exist in, you know, in these modern hunter-gatherer societies. They don't have, you know, ice cream. They don't have cake. They don't have potato chips. They, you know, have meat, you know, which is fat and protein. They have honey, which is basically sugar. And they have, you know, fruit, which is, you know, a carb. And they have starchy plants, which is a carb. They don't have these sort of chemically engineered sort of versions of foods that are meant to just tap into your reward system.
It's almost like those foods are hacking the brain because your brain feels like, I found something that doesn't exist. I need to binge on this. Who knows how long it's going to be around.
Absolutely.
And yeah. I think this goes back to your point earlier about one of the groups that you were talking about, where you said that up to 20% of their calories can come from honey at some mm-hmm. point in time. And then it can, at this season, it might change. Mm. And I think that the study, when I was reading it and I was reading your article, the other thing that came up for me is that your own personal diet might vary in the year. So some people say that they might do well on a vegan diet. Like I know right. A lot of my friends, especially during the summertime, feel like they might have less meat in their diet and that they might be more plant-based and that's what works for them. And then it might change later on. So it's not only just the variety between the different groups, but that there might be some variety that we have in our own diet throughout the year, because that might work for our genetics versus somebody else's genetics that's there.
Right, absolutely. The foods that they eat are seasonal and they're local, and they're foods that they adapted to eat, you know, at certain times of the year through many millennia. So, you know, that's very different from the way that we eat in the developed world, where we have avocados in the winter, you know, and we have other these other foods that, you know, maybe your ancestors didn't eat at that time of the year or eat at all.
A few years ago, a couple summers ago, actually, I went to northern Kenya to visit a modern day hunter-gatherer society. And we actually stayed in that region. It was with the group Summit Series. Mm. And we went to visit this tribe, which are cousins of the Maasai. It's called the Samburu tribe. Mm. And when we went to go visit this nomadic tribe, that every basically 9 months to 2 years, depending on when their grasslands are eaten up in the local area by their cattle or their goats, they move to another region. So they're setting up shop every time. So they're this nomadic modern day hunter-gatherer society. And when I was asking them about their diet, the individual who was interpreting for us, they were saying they actually don't really even eat that much. They chew on some twigs here and there. They eat some berries here and there. And then once or twice a month, they might have a ceremony or like a special occasion or a wedding where they might slaughter a goat or cattle. And in between then, they primarily live off of milk. And occasionally when there's not grasslands, they will puncture the vein in the neck of the cattle and they will primarily live off of blood. Mm. And we went to these societies and we were seeing them, and it's actually true. They're not eating on a daily basis. Mm. It's not even something that's there. So another example of how, and I think they've been a modern nomadic tribe, the way that they've been raising cattle and goats for about 900 to 1,000 years is the estimate. So just another example of that. There's even groups that are out there that are not even eating.
Yes.
And they're primarily surviving off of liquids.
Yeah.
And when I was asking about, well, what are the mortality rates and how old do they live? They said, you know, one of the challenges that's there is that many of these individuals, there's not an accurate estimate of when they were born. They don't have birth certificates. Yeah. But they did say that after you remove accidents and infant mortality, all the adults here are dying from natural causes, and most of them just pass away in their sleep. And then, you know, one morning the family wakes up and sees that they've passed away. They're not dealing with all the range of issues that we're dealing with.
Yeah.
And I thought it was super fascinating.
Yeah. And I think you touch upon another really important and crucial aspect about our developed, you know, diet that's very different from the way our ancestors evolved to eat, which is that we constantly are putting calories in our mouths. We have constant access to food. And you see this also, you know, with the Hadza. So when they wake up in the morning, you know, they can't go to the refrigerator and pull out, a bagel and, you know, spread some cream cheese on it. They have mm-hmm. to go out and actually hunt and forage for their food. And so each morning, you know, the Hadza men, you know, they will all get up together. The men and the young boys will go out and they'll hunt, and they may, you know, travel some days up to, you know, 10 miles hunting for small animals or for a large animal, or trying to gather honey if they fail at hunting. The women will go out and they will dig for tubers and, you know, starchy plants, maybe try to gather some berries. They may traverse up to 5 miles in a day. And, you know, they are digging to get these plants with, you know, sticks and wooden tools. And they sometimes are carrying babies and there are small children on their backs. It is like literally backbreaking work. And they're going out and getting these foods, and they don't really eat them when they're out getting them. They bring it all back to the campsite and then they have dinner together. But yeah, so they're not waking up and just immediately putting calories in their mouths. And, you know, they eat together at night, and then, you know, all the food is gone and there's no, you know, late night snacking. They can't, you know, go to the refrigerator or go to the pantry and grab a bag of Lay's potato chips, or go to the freezer and get a bag of, you know, ice cream. You know, once they finish all their food, if they're still hungry, you know, there might be a little bit of zebra left, or, you know, maybe a few berries. And so they're pretty much eating in a fairly time restricted window. And this is a lot of some other really important research that I've written about that I think.
Yeah, Sachin Panda,
who's done this work on time-restricted eating, where they've
actually
shown.
Yeah, I think your article is called, "Is there, when you eat, is more important than
what you eat.
Could be, I think.
Pretty sure that was it. Yeah. And he and his colleagues and others in this field actually did research showing that if you take animals in a laboratory setting and you, you know, take animals that are genetically identical, split them into different groups, you know, you give one group, you know, all of their all of their daily calories in, you know, a 6-hour window. The other group, you put them on an ad libitum diet, which means they can eat, you know, throughout the day or really throughout the night, because these are mice which are nocturnal, but they're allowed to access calories whenever they want. Both groups consume the same amount of calories, but the ones that are eating, you know, essentially whenever they want, even though they have the same amount of calories, same macronutrient composition, they become much more obese and they develop more chronic diseases than the ones who are eating their calories in a very narrow window of time. And you see this in humans as well. There have been some small clinical trials that have shown that people who are eating their meals in smaller windows throughout the day, they have better metabolic health than those who are eating calories throughout the day, especially people who are eating large meals late at night before they go to bed. And Sachin Panda did something really interesting where, you know, he asked people, you know, how often do you eat throughout the day? What's your sort of time window of eating? And people underestimated the amount of times they were eating throughout the day because people often forget about, you know, the sugar that they put in their coffee in the morning or their tea or the honey they put in there first thing when they wake up, or, you know, the bag of, you know, the handful of trail mix that they snuck, you know, late at night after dinner, or the glass of wine. But he found when he actually had people track every calorie that they put in their mouth that people were eating something like, you know, 18 hours a day. And so they're only giving their bodies, you know, essentially 6 hours or so at night to digest all this food they've consumed throughout the day. And they're not really giving their digestive tracts a break.
And I also, yeah, in his research, he talks about every organ in our body has its own like circadian rhythm, its own clock.
Yeah.
And so certain enzymes go up at night because we traditionally didn't need them, or like our digestive acids might be different. So when we're eating throughout the day, our body's not even functioning optimally.
Yeah. So you are getting, you know, if you look at all these, you know, all of our organs, we have, you know, our circadian rhythm, just like our brains. You know, if you stay up late at night and you skimp on sleep, the next morning you're going to feel pretty, you know, foggy. We all know what jet lag feels like when, you know, you're in one time zone, but your brain is in another time zone and you're, you know, losing sleep. Our organs experience that too, when we're constantly forcing, you know, food into our bodies and forcing our organs to digest food 18, 20 hours a day. And if you look at, you know, the pancreas, for example, it has an optimal window of time. The pancreas secretes insulin. It's most efficient in the morning and then it sort of quiets down at night. But if you're, you know, eating food, you know, at 10, 11 p.m., you know, you're forcing the pancreas to wake up and do a job that, you know, it's not prepared to do at that time of the day. So I think that's another big difference between our modern societies and hunter-gatherer societies when it comes to nutrition.
It's almost like they don't have an option. It's it's dangerous to eat food that late. You know, people are winding down. They have to be away from things. It's not the optimal time. And so it's baked into their, they're not thinking, okay, let me do time-restricted eating because that's going to be more helpful for us.
Yeah.
They're just living within nature, living within the environment. And the environment calls for them to be this way and to cook this way and to live this way. But even though our outer world has changed and restaurants and lights and staying up late at night and dinner as a primary vehicle of social connection in our Western society, our genetics have not changed.
Right. And that's another thing as well, is that, you know, in addition to eating, you know, in this very extended period of time, we also have, you know, these ultra processed foods that offer just a tremendous amount of variety. So, you know, the macronutrient compositions will be pretty similar. Essentially, they're delivery mechanisms for fat and simple carbs, but they come in all these different flavors. So potato chips, you know, ice cream, you know, pizza. There's just an incredible variety of foods. And that's one thing that these groups do not have. And there is a phenomenon known as sensory specific satiety. And that essentially refers to the fact that, you know, if you are at a, you know, a very nice steakhouse and you have a big, you know, delicious steak meal, you know, with maybe a buttery potato and some buttery broccoli, You know, you have this huge, tremendous meal. It's fantastic. You have some wine and you say, I am stuffed. I'm done. Like, that's it. I can't eat anymore. But then the waiter wheels out the dessert cart and now you've got a tiramisu sitting in front of you. You've got cheesecake. You've got, you know, chocolate cake. And suddenly you're like, oh, wow. I think I'm going to have to try a little bit of all of these.
Right.
And just 2 minutes ago, you were saying that you were stuffed. You were full. But now you have room for dessert. And so there's this thing called sensory specific satiety that means that you always have room for something else if there's variety. And if you live in one of these hunter-gatherer societies like the one that you visited, or you know, the Hadzo or the Chimani, they have, you know, pretty much they're eating, you know, protein, fat, carbs, but it's really from a handful of foods. You know, in this group that you visited, you know, if they're hungry, what are their options? Most of the time it's, you know, twigs or, you know, blood. In the with the Hadza, you know, if they're still hungry after dinner, they can maybe grab a little bit more zebra, maybe some berries, but you know, they have this very small select, you know, number of foods. And so, you know, they're not tempted by all this variety where they can always, you know, fit more food
and hit that reward center of the brain,
and especially tap into that reward center.
And I guess the question is that when I was reading that part of it, about the sensory specific,
satiety,
because we always hear about like these traditional societies having a lot of variety, but I guess the variety comes in the seasonality, right? They don't have a lot of variety in the day in terms of whatever's available is whatever they're going to get that day. Mm. And it's just the variety throughout the year, because, some of the research that was out there said, you know, that where in our modern Western society, we're eating corn, tomatoes, lettuce, potatoes. We have just a handful of things that we have, but in multiple different forms. Yeah. A lot of these hunter-gatherer societies had so many more things that they were eating, but the variety didn't happen on a daily basis necessarily. Right, it kind of came seasonality was the conclusion that I was interpreting from that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, and I think that still fits into it because the variety comes from, you know, plants.
Right.
You know, they tend to stay in a certain region. They might be nomadic and travel, but, you know, with the variety they're getting, it's from the earth. It's from, you know, different, like you said, you know, twigs. It's from different berries. It's from different, you know, plants and fruits. But that's very different from the variety you will see in a supermarket where you walk into, you know, the potato chip aisle and you've got 100 different, you know,
potato
bags
chips
of potato chips.
Flavor.
So you walk into the cereal aisle and there's just tons of aisles of so many foods that, you know, there's the produce section, you know, that's one sort of variety, but the aisles in the middle just have all these packaged foods that are just these, this incredible, just tremendous diversity of foods that are, you know, contain large amounts of refined carbs, sugar, fat. So if you're getting a variety from nature, from plants, that's a great way to get a lot of different nutrients. But if you're just eating, you know, a variety of foods that are just, you know, delivering, you know, fat and refined carbs and sugar, I think that's very different from a health perspective, at least.
Absolutely different. You know, when I was with this tribe, the Samburu tribe, as Western society, and of course, Kenya was ruled by the British, you know, once before, and many people there have westernized diets. This group has kind of lived in isolation. There have been a few members that have come out and have gotten educated and had all the great things that come with modernization. One of the challenges is in not even in a full generation, there was one gentleman that I met who was our guide and the go-between our group and this traditional tribes family. And he was kind of had a foot in both worlds. So he would eat the way that they ate, but this was also the first time in a matter of 5 years, 10 years since he's been eating westernized diet that he had been exposed to sugar. So one morning we all got up and I had brought coffee that, you know, I was going to make for everybody. So I made everybody coffee and he grabbed the coffee and was like, oh, this is like, it tastes okay. And I was like, oh yeah. Like, do you want me to add anything with it? I made like butter coffee.
Oh, okay.
He's like, no, I'm going to put a little bit of sugar inside. Okay, fine. Everybody takes their coffee a little bit different. And he went on to put, I counted 12 spoons. This is a small cup. And I realized in that moment that his brain was literally being hacked by this thing where he had never experienced having sugar before. I mean, he had had it over the last couple of years, but it's in less than a generation and just 2 years, 3 years, you're having somebody who never had sugar and has now had it for the first time and is completely addicted to it in a way.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think that that's the challenge when we start to look at, you know, the Native American societies and reservations where they traditionally were living a particular way and how much easier it is to when they get exposed to alcohol and sugar and the addiction that it can cause into mm-hmm. it. I think it's just interesting that as these hunter-gatherer societies, as we bring modern day education to them, often that comes with like a diet and other things. And in a way, it's a tidal wave of food that their bodies can't handle.
Yeah, absolutely. So this guy you said was drinking a cup of coffee that was buttered coffee. Yeah, and
12 spoons of sugar inside, teaspoons inside.
And see, that's something that he probably, there's the sugar component, but also the aspect of it being, you know, a large dose of fat with, you know, this abundance of sugar, that combination.
Right. That combination.
Just like you said, just taps into that primal part of the brain, the reward system, where you just got to keep having more and more. And I was interviewing this food addiction researcher once, and you know, she was talking about all these different foods that people are addicted to and that they struggle with, where they have these responses to them. And she said, you know, there's only one food in nature that combines a lot of fat with simple carbs and sugar. And you know what that is?
No.
Breast milk.
Oh, wow.
And if you think about it, you know, that is a food that's sort of designed,
yeah,
you know, for babies to want and to not be able to resist and to, you know, drink more of it. And it's also designed to be anabolic.
Right.
You know, when babies are born, you know, they need to grow big and fast very quickly. And I know this as a new parent, you know, you have your growth charts, you go to the pediatrician, the baby, you know, babies typically lose, you know, some weight after they're born, and then you need to feed them to get them to, you know, to put that weight back on and to grow. And they grow very quickly. And that's very important for the survival of our species. And so, you know, Mother Nature has sort of designed this, you know, this perfect anabolic food that's, you know, that babies love, which is, you know, it has a lot of saturated fat, it has, you know, sugar in it, it has carbs, it has obviously a lot of other very healthy, important things, immune cells,
bacteria,
like there's probably a million other things in breast milk that we don't even know about. But this is designed to be sort of nature's perfect food to help babies grow big and strong and fast. And this is, you know, we sort of have this explosion of ultra processed foods that have this combination of fat and sugar. And what are they doing to the population? They're making people grow big and fat and gain all this weight.
We're all addicted on an unhealthier version of breast milk.
Yeah.
That's giving us the exact opposite effects at the wrong
time.
Yeah.
So you want that when you're a baby, but right. Maybe not necessarily when you're an adult, you don't
Which
want
goes back to
be
the case of
anabolic.
Really should we be drinking milk in large quantities, and is milk a healthy thing?
Of course it has all these hormones, and what impact does that have? You know, there's been a lot of research there as well. So
I want to pivot to sugar, kind of following that sequence. And there was an article that you wrote in 2016, I believe it was, where you talked about the work in the sugar industry, and specifically how, you know, now I think society's paying attention. There's been a lot of articles talking about, like, does sugar make us fat, and is there other challenges? But for a long time, sugar was only seen as, okay, if you have too much, it might make you hyper, or it might ruin your teeth. There wasn't this understanding of all the research that was out there on how sugar can influence our body and our metabolism. And you talked about an article where you highlighted the work of the Sugar Research Foundation and two researchers that they had partnered with. Can you talk about what you were writing about inside of that article, and why it was so relevant to where we are as in a society in our relationship with sugar?
Yeah. So back in around 1980, with the first dietary guidelines for Americans, the dietary goals for Americans, sugar was mentioned as something that you shouldn't consume a lot of, but mainly because of the impact it could have on your teeth, or because it was empty calories. There wasn't really any mention of, you know, the metabolic effects of sugar. And for a while, sugar was given a pass. You know, there was all this focus on the impact of dietary fat on health and heart disease and obesity. And so the federal government recommended the low-fat diet for Americans because it was thought that fat was bad for you, especially saturated fat. And, you know, we all know that that led to an explosion of, you know, carbs, carb-laden and sugary foods that, you know, where the fat was stripped out, and replaced with simple carbs and sugar. Snackwells, you know, low-fat Snackwells being the perfect example of this. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, a few researchers actually looked at, you know, how did we get to this place where, you know, sugar was given a pass and all the focus was put on fat. And these researchers, one of them is named Stan Glantz. He's actually one of the big public health people that took on the tobacco industry. Kristen Kearns was another one. Laura Schmidt, they're at UCSF here. And they went back and found this really pivotal study in the New England Journal of Medicine from the 1960s that was written by some of the top public health people at the time who were based at Harvard. And another one of them actually helped to spearhead the first dietary guidelines. And they looked at this review paper they wrote that reviewed the cardiovascular effects of sugar and fat. And this review paper in NEJM, which is the top rated medical journal, basically said, there's this research out there where people are saying, some scientists are saying that sugar increases triglycerides and has other cardiovascular effects. And then there's this other research, showing that, fat leads to, increased cholesterol, and that's bad for heart disease. You know, we're reviewing the data, and from what we can see, fat is the primary culprit, and, sugar is really, not that bad. It's fat that we need to focus on. And this was a really pivotal paper in 1965 because it inspired a lot of other researchers to start focusing on fat, because at the time there was this
policy recommendations.
And policy recommendations, yeah. At the time there was this debate about, is sugar the culprit in heart disease or is it fat, which is worse? This paper came out and said, it looks like it's pretty much fat that is the culprit, and that was a landmark paper, I believe it was in 1965 in NEJM. Well, it turns out that these researchers who actually wrote this paper and did this review, this very influential review, were actually funded by the sugar industry. And they never revealed it. And these scientists at UCSF went back and they found this documentation that was hidden, stowed away in libraries, and that they finally, brought it to light and showed that, these researchers who wrote the review had been corresponding with the sugar industry. The sugar industry was very worried about, sugar being labeled the dietary culprit in heart disease. And so they funded the research to focus on fat and sort of, steer, attention away from sugar onto dietary fat. And, that was a very pivotal paper. And, it's believed that it had, a pretty big impact on the field of nutrition.
And you, I believe, had reached out to the sugar industry, the modern day, it was originally called the Sugar Research Foundation, and now it's called something else.
The Sugar Association.
And they said that, oh, we weren't trying to hide anything. Just back then, a lot of individuals didn't, it wasn't common to disclose where the funding came from, which might be true. But I think looking at all the documentation and the back and forth, there was, I believe the amount was 50,000 or something like that.
Yes.
Which back then was quite a lot of money for funding research.
Yeah.
And probably one of the greatest returns on investment that any association or lobbyist group has had, because of the effects that it had, especially when you have individuals that are creating the dietary policy and recommendations for the United States.
Right. And, Stan Glantz, who has, been doing work on tobacco control for decades and was one of the first guys to really, disclose the tobacco, documents that showed what the tobacco industry was doing behind the scenes to influence public policy and public perception of tobacco. He likened what the sugar industry did to what the tobacco industry did, which was, in very crafty ways, tried to manipulate the direction of research and policy. So, they didn't always necessarily fund research that was bogus, but what they would do is they would put money into research that, shifted attention away from the things they didn't want people to look at. So the tobacco industry would, fund, a lot of studies looking at causes of lung cancer that were completely unrelated to smoking. They would try to steer things in a very specific direction for their benefit. And it looks as though the sugar industry, did that back in the day as well. And it was sort of the hidden hand of the sugar industry. And there were other documents that came to light showing, for example, that this same group, the Sugar Research Foundation, had funded studies looking at the effects of sugar on cancer in mice and animals. And, you know, there was at least one study that was suggesting that, you know, there was a link between sugar and chronic disease. And they pulled the plug on that study and it, you know, never came to light and they just kind of shelved it. So they did these sort of things where they funded reviews to get, you know, the scientific field and policymakers focused on fat, and they, you know, funded studies. And if they didn't like the results, they pulled the plug and just buried them.
It's a little bit of part of what has led to this modern day understanding that, you know, you also had written about like Coca-Cola and the sugar energy, the energy balance.
The Global Energy Balance Network, yeah.
Global Energy Balance Network, which I'll have you talk about in a second. But essentially it was an organization that was started by a lot of the soda companies that was basically saying, look, it's not everything in moderation. And 100 calories from Coca-Cola is the same as 100 calories from broccoli. So let's not take away soda from kids. You know, it's going to make them unhappy. Let's just get people to exercise more. And that's going to be the solution. And that was part of in your bio when I was talking about some of the groundbreaking work that you've done out there. Can you just highlight that a little further, expand on what I set up?
Yeah. So that was actually one of my most pivotal investigative series. And that came to light because some obesity experts had noticed that there was this new group called the Global Energy Balance Network that was led by some exercise scientists that were, you know, basically trying to promote the idea that sedentary behavior is, you know, the biggest driver of the obesity epidemic, and that exercise is the solution to obesity. That's all about, you know, calories in and calories out. You know, we wouldn't be so fat if we would just, you know, eat our food, you know, drink our soda, and then get up and, you know, walk, you know, 5 to 10 minutes. We could all just exercise away the calories that we're eating. And it turned out that this group that was, you know, launching a pretty big, you know, public push to try to influence people's, you know, thoughts about diet and nutrition and exercise and obesity, this group was being quietly funded by the Coca-Cola and the food industry. And I had to file some FOIA requests to, you know, get the funding behind this group and to get emails. And what came to light was, you know, this group was pretty much the brainchild behind it was a VP at Coca-Cola, you know, the head of their regulatory affairs and one of their science people who thought, you know, we can fund these exercise scientists, get them to, you know, tell people to just focus on exercise. Don't worry about, you know, your calorie intake. Don't worry about, you know, they even put out a video that said that, oh, soda, you know, French fries, fast food, people blame obesity for that. It's not about what you're eating. It's all about exercise. People are just basically lazy.
Yeah.
And this was another, you know, sort of example of the food industry sort of working behind the scenes to influence people's perceptions behind some scientists that were friendly to them. And they were having a big impact. But this series that I did on the Global Energy Balance Network led to them shutting down and returning the money, and in one case, donating it to a charity.
And it's interesting to look at like all the different ways that this can influence the public. Even Michelle Obama, well-intentioned, completely well-intentioned, having her, every first lady has a main area that they want to focus on. And she said she wanted to focus on kids and obesity and helping kids get fit and started this whole national movement. The primary focus was on bringing back gym classes and exercises and moving more. And when we think about our policy, this idea that fat people are just, first of all, you know, just using that in terms of like, quote, fat people are just lazy. That's why this is happening. Not looking at the biological and metabolic effects of things like sugar in our diet and how it's hacking our brain and causing us to eat these things and directly contribute to putting on fat inside the body. So it goes back in a way, those two stories are kind of linked, that the sugar industry is like playing some of the same books. Yeah. That are out there. When you read things like that and you look at what the consumer is up against, I know you're a journalist and you have to stay neutral on it, But what would be your recommendation for people who are paying attention and trying to just make the best decisions and choices from themselves?
Right. Well, I think you raised some really important points. And the Let's Move campaign that Michelle Obama spearheaded, you know, was very controversial in some ways, because there's been some research showing that Let's Move was really meant to say, let's move on obesity. Let's move on, you know, on the food that we're eating and do something about it. Like, let's take action. But when she launched it, the biggest food industry lobbying group was very upset about it. Food industry was, you know, furious. And they basically, you know, there's some research suggesting that they got her to focus, to shift the focus to let's move, meaning let's exercise. So instead of being let's move on this issue, let's, you know, physically move and focus on exercise, because that's less controversial. We don't want to tell people to not eat certain foods. We just want to tell them to exercise. You know, and when you sort of look, you know, when I was doing this research for my investigative series, I saw that for the food industry, you know, they really adopt this mantra of, you know, calories in, calorie out, and this mantra of energy balance, that it's about balancing what you eat, you know, with the calories that you expend by moving and by exercising. But what's interesting, and this, you know, goes back to the Hadza and other hunter-gatherer groups, you know, they spend a lot of time doing physical activity. You know, as I said, the Hadza women, you know, will, you know, traverse maybe 5 miles a day, the Hadza men 10, sometimes 15 miles a day. And when, you know, and the same thing with a lot of other hunter-gatherer groups. And when scientists actually, you know, put activity trackers on them and looked at their, you know, energy expenditure, you know, they thought, okay, we're going to see, you know, some measures that are off the charts. Turns out that the Hadza actually expend roughly the same amount of energy per day as your average American office worker. So even though they're doing all this exercise, it's not like they're expending, you know, this enormous amount of energy. You know, it was very counterintuitive and very shocking. But what it looks like is going on is that your body's, you know, energy expenditure is sort of kept within a tightly controlled range. It's sort of like your body temperature. You know, your body has this thermostat, so that, you know, regardless of whether it's hot or cold outside, your body keeps your body temperature within a pretty tightly controlled range of about 98.6 degrees, regardless of what the ambient temperature is. Same thing with blood sugar. You know, your body doesn't want your blood sugar to go too high or too low, because that's dangerous. So it tries to keep it, you know, if you eat something, your blood sugar goes up, it tries to bring it back down to a certain stable level. And it appears that it might be the same with energy expenditure. If you are doing a lot of exercise, like the Hadza, you know, traveling 5 miles a day, 10 miles a day, or you're going to the gym, you know, doing all this exercise and burning all these calories, your body is going to try to push back in other ways by spending less energy on other physiological systems. So in the case of hunter-gatherers, it looks like, you know, the body devotes less energy to the immune system, or maybe less energy to producing hormones to try to keep your energy expenditure in a pretty tight range. And that, you know, sort of reflects the fact that obesity is not necessarily about, you know, calories in, calories out. Sure, you can, you know, exercise away a bad diet for a little bit, but in the end, you know, you can't always outrun a bad diet. And so it really comes back to what we're eating and what is, you know, what's going on with our food. And so I think people need to focus on that, you know, focus on what you're eating, you know, try to find the best diet for you, not for anyone else. We all sort of intuitively know which foods work for us. We know, like, which foods, you know, we eat make us feel a certain way. And I think we need to, you know, follow our body's signals and do what works for you and what worked for your ancestors. We know what diet doesn't work for people, and that is the, you know, the standard American diet. But there's a range of diets that work, can work for different people. And so you need to figure out the best one for you. You know, try to eat, you know, whole foods. You know, the studies suggest that you should try to limit, you know, ultra-processed foods. Try to get, you know, a diet that's very nutrient dense, you know, maybe high in fiber, you know, and a good variety of nutritious foods.
After investigating all these pieces and and looking into this and going back to through all the articles that you mentioned and others that we didn't, have there been other key things that you've brought into your world in terms of how you did things, or was there anything that you stopped or changed? I know you've always kind of been into nutrition and you grew up in a very healthy family that would put diet and cooking and all those things as a priority. But any things that you've changed in your own personal habits?
Yeah, so there are certain things. So I've definitely adopted the sort of time-restricted eating approach, and I find that works very well for me because I am someone who likes to snack a lot. I am definitely a grazer. You know, I'm not a big breakfast person. I like a good-sized lunch, a big dinner, and I like to snack in between. If left up to my own devices, I would just be snacking on things all throughout the day, and especially after dinner. My wife would joke around and say that she'd come into the kitchen at like 10:30 at night, and I'd be like cooking like chicken or like some like my sixth or seventh, you know, meal or snack of the day. And after looking at the research on time restricted eating, I became, you know, pretty persuaded by it, and I think it's pretty compelling. And so, you know, I tried to make sure that after dinner, you know, that's my last meal of the day, the kitchen is closed, and I give my body, you know, a few hours at least before bedtime, you know, to sort of digest my food. And then I, you know, go into sleep, you know, without feeling uncomfortably full. I wake up in the morning, I have, you know, a cup of green tea or maybe, you know, coffee if my son was up in the middle of the night and I'm pretty tired. But I try to, you know, eat within, you know, a pretty like time restricted eating window. Not
is that
like,
usually like the recommendation of like the 8 to 10 hours?
So usually, you know, I'm not super strict. I'll try to do like maybe 11, 12 hours on a typical day. And then maybe once a week or so, I'll do, you know, what I consider a longer fast. So like I said, I'm someone who likes to snack. So for me, a 16 hour fast is a long period of time. I think the longest I've gone is like 18 hours. But for me, that works pretty well. And I find that's something that I've recommended to other people and they try it and they say, oh, you know what, this actually is kind of, you know, might be a little tough the first couple nights, but after, you know, a little adjustment, you realize, oh, I don't actually need to eat a snack after dinner. That's just sort of force. That's just habit. You know, your body's just used to it, just like you're used to coffee first thing, you know, every morning. But if you know, go a few days, you know, your body, you know, goes through the withdrawal period and then, you know, adjust. Some people, you know, you adjust. It's just, you become sort of accustomed to certain habits. So that's one thing I try to implement with my diet. And I just try to, you know, cook a lot of my own foods when I can and eat, you know, whole foods, get, you know, a certain amount of plants and protein and healthy fats throughout the day. I eat a lot of nuts and seeds. You know, in the morning, I'm not a big breakfast person, so I eat like kind of a small sort of low carb breakfast, like maybe a small bowl of like plain yogurt with some almond butter and some, you know, flaxseed. I try to eat fish because of the, you know, the omega-3s are so important for health and for anti-inflammatory purposes. So I try to get a good diversity of foods and keep it within a certain, you know, relatively a reasonable window of time. And those are some of the sort of broader rules I follow. The other thing I've noticed too is that even when you look at hunter-gatherers, there's more to, I think, their avoidance of chronic diseases than just what they're eating. They also, you know, have a very particular lifestyle. So, you know, they are very social. You know, they live and travel together throughout their lives in the same group. You know, they wake up each morning, you know, as a group, they go out and hunt in small groups. They have a very egalitarian society where, you know, whatever they hunt or gather or forage, they bring it back to the camp at night. After dinner, they stay up late, you know, telling stories by the campfire. You know, there's no one trying to get ahead. There's no one trying to become the CEO. No one, you know, is gathering all the money and, you know, there's not a lot of inequality. And they, you know, are just very, know, social and good to one another. And so, especially now that I have a son, I try to enjoy my family time a lot and try to, you know, I can get pretty busy sometimes, you know, especially being a journalist when I'm on deadline, I, you know, can get a little frenzied thinking about trying to get my stories in on time. But, you know, I try to do a little meditation each day when I can. some mindfulness so that I recognize the important things in life and sort of cherish, you know, my family time and my son and my wife and those things. So I think it's about following a good diet. It's about exercising for the sake of improving your cardiovascular health, not necessarily to lose weight. You know, exercising, you know, to improve your aerobic fitness, your cardiovascular health, to lower your risk of cancer and chronic diseases, sort of looking at exercise as a good way to protect your overall health and to, you know, try to retain some of your youthfulness, and then focusing on mindfulness and enjoying, you know, your family and friends.
Yeah. I've read a few articles that say that a lot of these hunter-gatherer societies, and I don't know if they touched on it in this study that you mentioned. I don't remember seeing it, but I didn't write an article about it, so you know better than me. But they had a lot of downtime. They had downtime, and we imagine them to be just running around gathering food all day long. And even though getting food and hunting does take up time, they would have downtime for singing, for rituals. When we went to visit this group in Kenya, the Samburu, they would sing songs in the evening. The women would make beads together, and they invited a lot of the women that were part of our group, and they had this time where they could be, reflect, and they're not always frantically running around looking for food. They can just exist sometimes in a community setting and have that support. The other thing that was really interesting thinking about society and community is that our host was translating to us. They said, you know, in our society, everybody kind of knows that they have a role, and nobody feels like they're not part of the tribe. Mm. They know their role, and their role might change based on their age. And there's never this sense of like, where do I fit in? Where do I fit in? Who am I? You know, how do I fit into this component? Now, I'm sure there's good and bad in that. You know, we've all had the thing of coming from a family where everybody might be a doctor or everybody might have a particular tradition. So I don't want to romanticize every aspect of it, but I thought that was really unique of knowing what your place is and that the group relies on you in some capacity or another, even at a young age, and how that can help prevent with the sense of loneliness that a lot of people are feeling in today's society.
Right. I think that is such a hugely important point. And that's one thing that unfortunately you see a lot of in today's society, you know, this sort of epidemic of loneliness. And that's, you know, this is obviously a controversial hot button issue, but that's, you know, it seems like that's one of the, you know, commonalities that you see, you know, with these mass shooters. You know, sadly, there's, you know, this epidemic of loneliness, and people are seeking community. And, you know, I think there's a lot of depression, there's a lot of chronic stress. You know, when you look at more traditional societies, there is, you know, the communities are much more close knit. You know, I remember I was, you know, studying the, you know, looking at the blue zones, and these are these populations of sort of the, you know, the longest lived people on Earth. And one of the these blue zones where you see, you know, longevity is in Okinawa, you know, in Japan. The Okinawans are some of the longest lived people on Earth. And I remember interviewing the scientist who, you know, works with the Okinawans there, and she studies them and looks at their health habits and what are the reasons why they live so long. And I was asking her about nutrition, and then she sort of, you know, she told me about their diet, and then she segued into, you know, they all, you know, these people who, you know, live past 100, they all have certain habits. They have certain ways that they start their days in the morning. They wake up, and, you know, I was asking her about what they eat for breakfast, and she was like, they wake up and they don't really even eat breakfast at first. What they do is they gather with their friends and they drink green tea, and they spend a couple hours just sitting around catching up with their friends or their family, just like sitting in these small little homes, just like talking, you know, and being social. You know, they have these close-knit communities. And I think this was several years ago, and that was when it really started to dawn on me that, you know, it's obviously about much more than diet, and it's, you know, your quality of life and your lifespan has a lot to do with stress, you know. And do you have, you know, friends and family that you can draw on? Do you have, you know, an outlet for stress? You know, are you suffering from loneliness, depression? You know, I think one other thing that I found really interesting was that, you know, if you look at sort of the leading risk factors for cardiovascular disease, you know, that have come from studies, things like blood pressure, increased cholesterol, you know, high blood sugar, smoking, you know, these are things that mainly came out of the Framingham study from the 1950s and 60s. And this was a study where scientists, you know, at that time were unsure, you know, what are the factors driving heart disease? And they decided to focus on, you know, the small community in Massachusetts, Framingham, where they followed these people for decades and followed
32 years, right?
Yeah. Like 3-4 decades, in some cases following their children, you know, and just studying all these aspects of, you know, their health to see what are the factors that are most closely associated with cardiovascular disease and mortality. And so they found these things that we all take for granted today. Blood pressure, obviously, smoking, cholesterol, triglycerides, you know, lack of exercise, all these things. What's interesting, though, is that, if you look at when they were planning that study, you know, they had all these things they wanted to look at. And one of the factors that they were going to study was stress. They were going to look at people's stress levels, look at their levels of stress from work, their levels of stress at home, you know, family stress. And they decided, unfortunately, at that time, that they weren't going to study stress, you know, when following, you know, this group of people, because they thought it was too much of a soft measure. Mm-hmm. You know, you can sit someone down and you can take their blood pressure and get a hard number, you know, in a matter of seconds. You can draw someone's blood and find out, you know, how much cholesterol they have, you know, in their bloodstream. You can find out their level of triglycerides. You can ask someone how many times they smoke a day, but how do you actually quantify their stress levels? And so, unfortunately, with the Framingham study, they decided to leave stress out of this longitudinal study. And so that's how we got these other like hard risk factors and hard measures. And I think if they had included stress in that study, then today we'd have a much greater appreciation of, you know, the role of chronic stress in health and disease. And that's something that I think needs to change. And I think there's now sort of a greater or an increasing awareness of stress. That's why you see more people engaging in mindfulness, adopting these habits, and you're seeing more studies of meditation and mindfulness and the impacts on chronic disease.
It's amazing the impact that one study can have in sort of in the recommendations for
individuals. Whether it's sugar or fat or with stress and brain damage, these studies have a pretty big influence on policy and public perception.
So I want to come back to, and I want to conclude with longevity, and specifically going back to strength training and exercise. You wrote an article and the title was How to Get Strong. Mm. And you talked about how resistance training, especially as we get older and we start to lose muscle, is so important to our longevity. Can you summarize some of the findings that were there and how important resistance training is if we want to be serious about longevity?
Right. And I think this is another topic that's sort of overlooked, or another area of health that people don't really appreciate. So I think the latest numbers were that only about 6% of Americans actually get the recommended amount of resistance exercise in a week, and that's 2 sessions a week. So,
and can you define for anybody listening and they've heard the word resistance, like, you know, what is resistance compared to like just general like exercise that people might do?
Sure. So there's, you know, the aerobic exercise that we all know is important. So, you know, your cardio, running on the treadmill, you know, Stairmaster, those things. But strength training is any sort of exercise that puts resistance on the muscles. So we're talking about things like the most basic things like push-ups, bicep curls, you know, squats, and they could be body weight squats. Just things that are really forcing, putting a lot of, you know, stress and resistance on your muscles and getting them to be metabolically active.
Yeah, not running.
Yeah. When they actually study long distance runners, they find that they have, you know, oftentimes good muscle composition in their legs, but not so much in their upper body. So you get some resistance exercise, obviously, from running, but you
not full
sort
body.
Of ignore your upper body. And it's incredibly important to develop your strength and some muscle mass because it is very metabolically active and very protective. So we all know that obesity is bad. We know the impact that obesity has on heart disease and, you know, it increases your risk for cancer, diabetes, all these conditions, and can shorten your lifespan. But when they actually did studies comparing your BMI, your body mass index, which is a measure of obesity, it's your weight divided by your height. They compared that to another measure of health called the muscle index, the MI. And that's where they take your muscle mass and divide it by your weight. And they actually found in studies that your muscle index is a much better predictor of premature mortality than your BMI. And they also did studies where they followed, you know, thousands of people for decades and, you know, looked at different measures that predict their mortality rates. And they found that one pretty good predictor was your grip strength. You know, if you had a higher grip strength early on, you had a lower mortality later on. And that all suggests that, you know, you need to have some muscle. You don't need to be a bodybuilder, look like a bodybuilder, do a bodybuilder workout, but you need to have, you know, some muscle mass. It's very protective for your health and potentially very helpful for longevity. And, you know, there's a lot of good science showing why. So, you know, at the cellular level, you know, one of the indicators of aging are your mitochondria. You know, most people learn in high school biology that your mitochondria are the sort of powerhouses of the cells. They're the fuel cells of your cells. They're like the little engines, you know, the motors. And they find that as people age, you know, you see a pretty big difference in their mitochondria when they're older versus when, you know, people are younger. Your mitochondrial function sort of slows down and your mitochondria start to wither. And that's one of the, you know, signs that you're aging at a cellular level is the health of your mitochondria. And at the Buck Institute for Aging Research, they actually did studies where they put older people on, you know, through a 6-month strength training program and found that, you know, when they looked at their mitochondria again, they didn't look like the mitochondria of 25-year-olds, but, you know, they had sort of gained decades of, you know, their youthfulness back. So they were actually able to, at a cellular level at least, look, you know, decades younger. And so it looks like, you know, if you engage in some sort of strength training or resistance exercise, you are benefiting your body at the cellular level and, you know, promoting youthfulness and longevity.
Yeah, and there's a lot of different theories. And one of them is that through strength training and resistance training, you're sort of telling your body like, hey, whip into shape. We got to be stronger. And so the body kills off the old mitochondria.
Right.
And starts creating new ones to rise to the occasion because it needs to be stronger.
Right.
And we'll see how that interpretation goes on. But it definitely seems to be some element of... if you don't use it, you lose it.
Exactly. I was about to say that, use it or lose it.
Use it or lose it.
And there's all these other really important reasons to do strength training. So when you look at the leading killers of Americans, you know, heart disease, cancer, lung disease, you know, diabetes, obesity related conditions, you know, anyone listening to this, you know, you have a pretty high risk of dying from heart disease or a stroke. You know, that's the leading killer of not just Americans, but people around the globe. It's the number one killer. You look at these top killers of people in the developed world, and one of the underlying themes is, or common denominators, is insulin resistance. You know, insulin resistance is the precursor to type 2 diabetes. It increases your risk for Alzheimer's, for cancer, for heart disease. It's sort of this underlying sort of risk factor for all these leading killers of Americans. And one thing that strength training does is it helps you develop muscle. And when you put on muscle, your body becomes the opposite of insulin resistant. It becomes insulin sensitive because when you're insulin resistant, you have, you know, poor blood sugar control. Your body, you know, can't handle the blood sugar very well. When you're insulin sensitive, your body has much better blood sugar control. And the way that works sort of with muscle is that muscle acts like a sponge, like a sink. It soaks up, you know, the blood and or the sugar. The blood glucose rather. And so it makes you more insulin sensitive. So putting on a little bit of muscle mass makes you more insulin sensitive. It's sort of like a metabolic coat of armor. You know, and it goes back to what you were saying, use it or lose it. Your muscles, you know, want to soak up this glucose if you're being active and physically fit and you're lifting weights. And this is one of the best ways to increase your insulin sensitivity. So it's pretty important. And I think that it's, unfortunately, often overlooked when it comes to exercise.
Yeah, and hopefully through more awareness and the articles you're writing and these podcasts, people become more familiar with just how important it is. And I think the other aspect of muscle that's so important is that there are many individuals that numbers are very high that you get a stroke, your mobility is lowered, and now you're just getting up from the couch and going over to the kitchen, and you get a hip fracture because right. you don't have mobility and stability. We just had Peter Attia on Dr. Hyman's podcast, Doctor's Pharmacy. Peter, and they were talking about longevity and how so many individuals, when they're older, you'd go to any senior citizen home or talk to older people, many individuals have had a fracture or hurt their knee, and that reduced their mobility, which further puts them down the cycle of not being mobile. So they're losing more muscle, and that has all sorts of downward spiral effects on components.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people don't recognize that, you know, we see these chronic conditions in the elderly, but one of the ways that, you know, people end up dying very quickly is that, you know, like you said, they fall down, they have a hip fracture, and then they're immobile, they're in bed, and then they sort of, you know, wither away. And, you know, that's one of the sort of things that hastens death in the elderly. And I'm a big fan of Peter Attia. He and I have actually done at least two or three strength training workouts together.
Oh, that's amazing.
So Peter is someone who's focused on longevity, and I think it's telling that, you know, one of the ways that he tries to, you know, maximize his lifespan is by engaging in resistance training and making sure that his, you know, that he has that muscular development and does these resistance training
centenarian Olympics.
Yes,
that he has.
Exactly.
And if you don't know what that is, you can listen to that podcast with the Doctor's Pharmacy and Dr. Hyman and Peter Attia. All such important things. And, you know, just tying it back to where we started off, you know, these modern day hunter-gatherer societies, and these hunter-gatherer societies that have since, you know, we've since evolved from and are no longer with us, you know, they didn't go to fitness classes. They didn't lift weights. They didn't have, you know, things that are there. It was baked into their life. They had to go uphill. Many of the blue zones actually are, you know, Dan Buettner in his work talks about the blue zones being, even the one in California, the Loma Linda, they're all in sort of hilly areas. So they're constantly walking up and down, and fitness wasn't something they went to go do, but it was just baked into their life and baked into the world. Now we live in different times. And I think the thing is that people are always trying to figure out, if I don't like going to the gym, if I feel like that's not fun, how can I make this fun and how can I incorporate it in? So as somebody who is very fit, what are the tips that you'd give for people to make it practical and integrate this habit change into their life when it comes to strength training?
So I think with strength training, you can, you know, do things that are as basic as like a 5-10 minute workout at home. So in this article I wrote, it's called How to Get Strong. You can find it online. I provide two different workouts that you can do. One is a workout that you can do at home with a set of resistance bands that you can get on Amazon for about $20. You can do it, you know, this workout each morning. It'll take you no more than 10 minutes max. You know, do it to start your day. You know, it'll wake you up and sort of revitalize you, like a cup of coffee, give you that energy, and you get to work your muscles, and you do it pretty quickly and efficiently. The other workout I provided is a workout you can do, you know, if you go to a gym. And so you have different options for doing strength training. But even if you're someone who absolutely hates exercise, you know, you hate going to the gym, you can't bring yourself to do much structured exercise, just get out and walk. You know, there are lots of studies showing now that just getting out and walking is so beneficial to your health. And it's probably for a lot of reasons, but you see this in the modern hunter-gatherer societies. Like you said, it's you know, exercise is just baked into their cultures. And, you know, like I said, it's not about, you know, don't worry about how many calories you're burning. It's just about, you know, getting the blood flowing throughout your body. It's about being outside with nature. These modern hunter-gatherers, you know, they don't live indoors. They spend all their time outdoors. They're constantly enjoying, you know, sunlight and fresh air. You know, in Japan, they have a practice called forest bathing, where they just go into the forest and they walk. And there's been studies suggesting that there are, you know, beneficial compounds, volatile organic compounds that come from the trees that, you know, promote health directly. And then also just the act of physically walking. You know, like I said, it's not about burning the calories per se. It's just about, you know, getting the blood flowing, getting your muscles moving, allowing your body to dispose of the blood glucose in your bloodstream. And there's this researcher at Hunter College in New York, Herman Ponzer, who's done a lot of the work on the HADSA. And, you know, he, you know, hooked them up with these accelerometers and studied, you know, their energy expenditure levels. And he's the one that found that they actually don't burn much more energy, you know, despite all this exercise, than your average American office worker. And he thinks one of the reasons why exercise is so beneficial for them is that it sort of calms their immune systems. You know, so their bodies need to conserve energy because they're doing so much physical activity. So their bodies spend less time or devote less resources to the immune system. And we know that a lot of diseases, chronic diseases that kill Americans, do involve the immune system. You know, atherosclerosis, you know, involves white blood cells and macrophages engulfing cholesterol. Inflammation obviously is a big driver of disease. And so he thinks that by doing all this physical activity, they're sort of, you know, pulling energy away from their immune system. And so, you know, their bodies are not constantly looking to, you know, attack invaders or
autoimmunity,
autoimmune diseases. Yeah. This goes back to the hygiene hypothesis. We know that, you know, kids who are raised in very sterile environments and urban dwellings have more allergies and issues than kids who grew up on farms. There was even a really cool study showing that kids whose mothers clean their pacifiers in their mouths actually have fewer allergies and develop stronger immune systems than the moms who, you know, pick up the pacifier and wash it off with soap and water and then put it back in the mouth. I'm not making any recommendations there. I'm just saying that was a really cool, interesting finding. But the idea is that we live in these, you know, environments that are much more sterile than the environments that we evolved to live in. And so our immune systems, you know, are always looking, you know, for something to do in a sense. You know, it's sort of like if you have a, if you've ever owned a dog, you know, you know, you leave your dog home all day. You know, when you get home at the end of the day, what happens to your apartment? You know, it's all torn up. The dog has, like, you know, chewed through the rug, chewed up your shoes, you know, it's just going stir crazy. It's sort of, the analogy is that it might be similar with the immune system. If you live in this sterile environment, or you're not being physically active, then your immune system, you know, sort of goes a little haywire, according to, you know, these scientists, and you need to essentially take your immune system out for a walk, expose it to, you know, to fresh air,
exercise,
you know, get your body to focus on physical activity instead of your immune system having all this, you know, energy it needs to expend and looking for, you know, trouble it can cause and inflammation it can incite.
It's like, what's my purpose? I have nothing to do. Okay, let me go just attack
something.
Attack something. Super.
Yeah. So then you start to latch on to innocuous, you know, compounds, and that's how you develop these allergies. That's sort of one of the theories behind it. But that's, so that's one of the other benefits of exercise is, it's not just about burning calories. It's about, you know, the cardiovascular benefits. It's about, at least with hunter gatherers, it looks like, you know, their bodies are so focused on the physical activity that, you know, it sort of calms these other physiological systems down.
Well, Anahad, in a world where I think it was, I can't remember where I saw it was published, but I saw there was like 40% of headlines in news articles about a study or a food or a new thing that's out. They were talking about the study, you know, in whatever paper or online magazine that was there. And 40% of the headlines didn't even match what the study was talking about. I don't know if you've seen this literature.
Yeah, I have, yep. A big problem.
In a world where there's so much confusion and things are being reported inaccurately, your well-researched and investigative pieces, summaries of the studies and the latest literature that's out there in diet, nutrition, lifestyle, and other topics that you cover is such a breath of fresh air. So I want to thank you for all the great journalism you've done to really highlight and put some of these things out into the greater lexicon, and to have more society paying attention to these things that are so integral to our longevity and feeling good. I really appreciate you for that.
Thanks for having me. No, it's been great being on and chatting with you. And I think, you know, this is another avenue for people, you know, to get their health information, and you're educating people and reaching people in a very fun, engaging, fascinating way. And you have such a great diversity of guests on. So I'm honored to be on. So thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And we'll be sure to link to all your articles in the show notes. If people want to look you up separate from that, do you do any social media, any other places where people go find you?
Yes. So I am on Twitter at Anahad O'Connor. It's just my byline. But I've sort of, you can find me on there, and I definitely engage with people, but as part of my mindfulness and stress reduction, I try not to spend too much time on Twitter these days, although I am on there pretty frequently. So that's probably the best place to find me, or you can find me on the New York Times website, and I am on the health section, you'll see. You can contact me there. My email is there as well, so.
Well, beautiful. Thank you again, brother, for coming on the podcast. Super appreciate you and all the great work that you're doing.
Thanks for having me.